Welcome to Preaching Podcasts. For those who proclaim publicly, this is a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry, where we take a look at the lectionary from diverse and unique perspectives to help prepare church leaders for Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and with me today is Josh Davis and Althea Spencer-Miller. Hello.
Hello. Good
to be Hello, here. Everyone.
Wonderful. Wonderful to be with you. So today we are in the readings for Proper 20, the Sunday closest to September 21st. We're in that long season of Pentecost. We have got in the Hebrew Scriptures track one to the complaints. You know that you have been with a narrative for a long time when we are not so concerned about life, survival, deliverance from enemies, but we are now into complaining. Complaining means you've reached a different level of reality. So that's what's going on in Exodus 16. And in response to requests to Yahweh, Yahweh promises manna on a daily basis. And that's a motif that is resonant throughout the Bible, the giving of manna. Psalm 105 is a psalm of praise, remembering what the marvels God has done might be, spreading out the cloud for a covering, a fire to give light, and quails appeared upon request, and bread from heaven, and water, and God leads the people forth with gladness, and his chosen with shouts of joy. So this is a psalm of thanksgiving and praise. Jonah 3. This is the ending of the book of Jonah, which gives us a fabulous opportunity to discuss Jonah being really angry at the way in which God has saved Nineveh.
Oh, dear God.
Who knew that he would be so angry at God for this? But we'll discuss it. He's sitting under a tree, complaining about this mentally, and God is giving him shade, and he prefers to die rather than to live. And God says, why? Is it because I actually saved that pagan city, Nineveh, in which there are hundreds and thousands of people and many cattle? That's the ending of the book of Jonah. So we'll get to discuss that. It's just a fabulous ending. Epistle is Philippians. It's a great passage where Paul is in prison. We know that Paul is in prison writing the epistle to the Philippians. And in prison, he is deliberating. In the ancient world, there was much deliberation. There was a great deal of interest in survival, of course, but if you managed to stabilize your life, deliberating was one of the practices of people who had a bit more time even in prison. Is list of pros and cons. Should I do this or that? You weigh up the list of pros and cons. In this case, Paul is saying, to me, living is Christ and dying is gain. So he equivocates. If I am to live in the flesh, this means fruitful labor for me, and I don't know which I prefer. I'm hard-pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But it's for your sake, it's necessary for you that I remain in the flesh. Since I'm convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with all of you for your progress. This is the idea of development and growth, progress and joy in the faith. But it's an attempt by somebody without volition, you know, you're imprisoned, to make deliberation a part of the mental landscape of imprisonment. And I think that's worth pondering. Matthew 20, the wonderful parable it's about all kinds of things. It might be about laborers in the vineyard. It might be about paying everybody an equal wage, no matter how long they worked. It might be about the illogic of God's grace or something like this. Anyway, it's a great parable. So now, how to connect that with the collect? Grant us, Lord, not to be anxious about earthly things, but to love things heavenly. And even now, while we are placed among things that are passing away, I mean, we can see that this sort of connects to Philippians. It connects to the giving of manna and quails in the wilderness on a daily basis. But one has to trust that that's going to be the case every day. Prison life, to hold fast to those things that are not passing away, but that will endure. So that's about as much as I can do with that. So what do you think, Josh and Althea? What shall we discuss?
Well, I do love this parable because I think it really hits home in many ways with the way that we think about wages and work, especially the way that that wages and work is tied to time for us. And I think it's a really important part of our experience of the world, the way, you know, it's just various different things are calling for your time. I oftentimes think about how I would like, as an explanation of what I mean, I oftentimes think about all of the time that I spend on hold talking to cable companies, trying to fix internet problems. I would love to be able to bill them for those hours, right?
Yes.
Because somebody on the other side of that situation is getting paid for that time. And there's so many things that I can do with my time that I'd like to be paid for. And here I am not doing that because of a problem that they've created for me.
Yeah.
But here you have a situation where, at least in some respect, Jesus is saying, you know, this is about equity, or there's a way of looking at it that way. I'm not paying you based on the amount of time that you spent working for me, but on the basis of what you need. I mean, anybody working for me is going to need the wage to live. And so whether you started at the beginning of the day or the end of the day, I'm going to pay you the same. I just think it's an interesting way of inverting or transforming or challenging the ways that we tend to think about justice.
Yep.
And what you do.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because the actual language of Jesus, who gives the voice to the landowner in the second line of the text as we look at it, after agreeing with the laborers for the usual daily wage, he sent them into the vineyard. And he goes to collect other people, and then second line, he says to them, you go also into the vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right. And this is the word for just, whatever is just. So it's not just a daily wage. Yeah, so Josh, it really is connected to Matthew's understanding of righteousness and justice, because in Greek, these terms are connected.
It's dikaiosune, or
yes, dikaios, dikaios, whatever is right. Yes, but the English translation makes it difficult to see the connection with righteousness,
right,
with justice, because righteousness and justice are not naturally connected in English-speaking people's worlds, but in a Greek world, they would be connected to dike. Dike would be justice, dikaiosune is righteousness, so you would naturally get that connection. And from the word go, Matthew has created a narrative in which Joseph is called a righteous individual. The minute we meet anybody that has anything to do with Jesus, like Joseph, his adoptive father, Joseph is going to do the right thing, not the thing that is expedient, which is to divorce or separate Mary from him because she is found to be with child before they're married. But the angel tells him. So it's kind of like a divine you have to have your head turned around, and in order to get your head turned around, you have to have an angelic intervention.
Yeah.
To figure out what is right and what is just. And the just thing is to save the child and his mother and flee to Egypt, which is counterintuitive. It's non-rational. So it's not even what you need. It's not even what is reasonable. It is a different way of looking at justice.
And that's the kind of connection that I just love for that reason. And also because it enables me to start to think about connections between, you know, the economic connections that are here in this parable, along with righteousness, but then the way Paul will talk about it. I mean, that's the same root word for justification.
Absolutely.
So, you know, those are the kinds of connections that I love, that take it out of this just purely abstract legal kind of thing. Like you were guilty, but now I'm just going to say that you're not guilty. And instead it has something, it's about something else here.
Right. Right. So equality is not equal work for equal pay.
Right.
Equality is what is right.
Right.
So I probably have told you both this, but this is our gospel that we chose when we got married.
Ooh. Oh.
Because this will be the only gospel you ever hear in a wedding ceremony. Nobody else in their right minds would choose this. Okay, so the reason we chose it is because we have come lately to the vineyard and our marriage has now been able to be recognized. You know, it was not possible to be married because gay marriage didn't exist when we were first together. We could have had, you know, same-sex union, and we did do that in New York City Town Hall. But getting married was a big deal. I don't mean that we spent a lot of money. We didn't at all. We had it very quietly in a small little church in a state that recognized before New York same-sex marriage. But we said to the wonderful priest, Molly McGreevy, who married us, she was a priest at St. Luke in the Fields in New York City, a graduate of General Seminary. Her husband was an actor on TV and so on. She was just, you would love her. She was just wonderful. She was bright and funny. We said to her, this is our gospel. And she understood it immediately. She said, you know what she said? She got him and she said, what took you so long?
Oh, well.
It was the state's fault.
Right.
We've been ready.
But she understood it. She understood it immediately. So this was the gospel that we love, because we want to stand up and be laborers in the vineyard of marriage. We want to stand up, you know, and get a support for the work of marriage. Marriage is work. It's work. You know, it's joy and love and light, but it's also work. And we want this public recognition and this work. So anyway, it's a gospel that's dear to my heart.
Yeah, we've been working all day.
That's not quite the way we might be able to preach it, but it's a start.
But you know, one of the there's a lot going through my mind, but one of the images that I often get in class connected to this passage, it's how to, and connected to something that Josh said, you know, it's how to get paid for waiting. Yeah. And the image of Latinx workers at train stations, on sidewalks, before community centers, waiting all day. Some get picked up early in the morning and they go. And then there are others who are waiting all day till the last moment, when the whimsicality of the day finally produces someone who's going to pay them, you know, to do an hour's work. Yep. How do you pay them for having waited all day?
Yeah.
You know, how do you
yeah,
reward them for that kind of endurance, an endurance that we don't recognize as worthy of merit or reward?
It's a great way to look at that parable. Great way.
But an alignment I saw too, a parallel I saw, as you spoke, Deirdre, about waiting to get married. You know, it's the alignment between the landowner, and something about the kingdom of heaven and the state.
Yeah.
And the body of people, that collective that makes up the state, that you have to wait so long for the recognition that comes from those with the power to decide.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's such an intriguing dynamic.
Yeah.
You know, that the power, those with the power to decide, finally get the thing right in some way.
I didn't think that it would matter, to be perfectly honest. Because, you know, we were living together And we had already had a big argument with the seminary about living together at the seminary.
Wow.
With the New York City Human Rights Commission and all kinds of things and so on. It was a crazy, it's in the New York Times, so you can read about it that way. Just in passing. So, you know, we'd gone through a lot of stuff to get to live
twice
together.
Twice for you.
Yeah, twice, exactly. Two strikes and you're out, Josh. That's what happened. No, I'm not joking. That's what happened. But when we did it, it was magical. I mean, I suppose, you know, I am a Church of Ireland Anglican, you know, I'm pretty low church, but sacraments are not quite what they are for a lot of Episcopalians here. But I must say that it was to be married is just a fabulous thing. It's a fabulous thing. I just had no idea how much it would mean. So, and I'm trying to put that in the context of waiting, Althea, of waiting.
Yeah.
Not knowing that the state that you would aspire to was really even much more than you had hoped it would be or expected it to be. Yeah. The state of value, you know, the regularization of value of, yeah, something like that.
You mean with in marriage?
Yeah, in marriage. Exactly. I'm trying to think about payment for
right.
for wages as well, by which value is signified.
But I also think, I mean, this is not explicit in this passage, but if you used the Latinx workers
yeah.
waiting to be paid, there is something indeed beyond earning the money or what earning money symbolizes. A way of dignifying one's existence and
yes.
recognizing one's will to be responsible and
yes.
accountable and contributory, that when you eventually get this wage,
yes.
you know, I have a little difficulty saying this, but when you eventually get this wage for what it represents, it's as if in this moment you have been humanized.
Yes.
You know, and something deepened, a recognition given to your existence and your capacity to participate fully, even for an hour,
yes.
in the human race.
Yes.
And I'm sort of putting that, I don't know that they're necessarily equal, but that symbolic reward that gives you a kind of having waited. Is epitomized perhaps in the marriage and analogy that you're using there.
That's right.
But having had that high note, I've got to admit, in our pre-podcast conversation, Deirdre, it might be my hysterical response to the times, but I latched on to the laughter, the satire in Jonah.
Yeah.
And so I don't quite think this fits. But it's interesting that how the lectionary puts things together, and puts texts together, and I wondered if when they worked on this set of readings, if they had the same laugh that you did, because Matthew 21-16, the second to last sentence, or are you envious because I'm generous?
Yes,
has tones of Jonah. The way God ends up with Jonah.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because
I'm generous?
Yes. Yes, it's not. In the Greek of this passage in Matthew 20, it's, is your eye evil because I am good? So it's the evil eye. Do you have the evil eye? Now, there are cultures for whom the evil eye is still operative. You go to the airport in Istanbul, and there is a giant circle above you hanging from the ceiling, and it's a blue, you know, it's the amulet that wards off the evil eye. So the evil eye is alive and well. But yes, are you angry because I'm generous, Jonah? And apparently Jonah is going to go off being angry. That's how the book ends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, I began calling Jonah the unwilling hero,
yeah.
the disgruntled hero, the querulous yeah. hero.
Yeah.
But he does articulate a bit of a quandary, could we say? That choice, and I'm hearing it echoed in a much more sober way in Paul's, and deeper way in Paul's wrestling between life and between dying and living, when dying for him is also a form of living, you know. But it's here you have Jonah, and something good is going to happen to these folk, but whatever good is going to happen to these folk is not all that good for him, so he'd rather not have that good happen to them. And the God whom he is allied to whom he gives his allegiance, is going yep. to carry out this really, really bad betrayal of Jonah's interests.
The quandary.
Yeah, he says all the right things. He prays to the Lord under the little plant right at the end. This is what I've said from the beginning. This is why I went the other way when you said go to Nineveh, because I knew, here comes all this religious language, that you are a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger and abounding. In other words, you've kept faith with pagans, you know, who haven't been paying you any attention at all. And their cattle, for God's sake, you know, all the flora and fauna in Nineveh, you value this more. And now, he says, take my life. It's better for me to live than to die. So there are people who, when presented with what is good and true and upright and just, and even, you know, a sign of God's fidelity and love, say, I would rather die. I mean, is that not, I'm holding my head, is that not astonishing?
Yep.
And so I would say that there are rational people who don't want same-sex people to be married.
Yeah.
Don't want us to exist.
Yeah.
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 So
I don't think, let me just say, I don't think that you can have too much love. And if you look at people who love each other and whose love can be for a greater and wider good than just themselves, you know, who have children, families, jobs, household lives, things that are contributing to a community, to the well-being and upkeep of the community. How can you say, we don't want that love? We'll have this love, but not that love. And by the way, I don't imagine that people who are listening to this have any qualms about it. I should just say that within my family, I have always had to make this argument, because my father never, ever accepted us as a gay couple and died. You know, at the point of his death, he said, there are some things I regret. And that was about it.
Oh, wow.
So I just speak out of my own history in this regard. If there's feeling that you're sensing, that's what it is.
Yeah. And therein is the poignancy, perhaps. I'm doing what I tend to do, which is to ride inside the English words in these passages. But there's a sense in which I'm looking at the collect. While we're placed among things that are passing away, to hold fast to those that shall endure. And that's what Paul says about love in 1 Corinthians 13. This is a thing that endures. And in every one of these passages, well, I won't say every one, but certainly in Exodus, in Jonah, in Matthew, there is a sense of having to confront magnanimity when caught inside the smallness of our own interests and loyalties. And what a journey of disgruntlement we undertake. Rebellion, resistance to this greater goodness of God, where to trust God's magnanimity and the magnitude of what God calls us into in love is to trust that love, or that higher value, as the end of the journey, is actually worth the risk, worth the chance, worth getting out of our own narrowness and grabbing for the thing that's so much bigger, that love.
That's very good, Althea. It's very helpful. Very helpful. To make those connections, you know, the complaints of Exodus, the complaints of Jonah, and the complaints of the laborers in the laborers who'd worked the longest in the vineyard. That's really helpful.
Yeah. But I'm still sort of caught up with your laughter, Deirdre. You know? And in the Jonah passage, I almost can hear God laughing at Jonah. I have this image of God there tickling his toes with a leaf and saying, you know, you're concerned about a bush?
Yeah.
You can do anything, you know?
Yeah,
come on, Jonah.
Yeah,
get out of this.
Yeah. It's true.
You're concerned about a bush? I'm concerned about Nineveh. Come on. What's the comparison here?
The figure of Jonah too in all of this is so interesting because of like the idea of being given a message to speak to people that you resent them turning from it is also really interesting.
It is
brutal. Right?
It is. It is.
So I mean, because so often these kinds of messages of prophetic messages are things that which you have some personal investment in some way. And it's just one of these interesting things. Like you're called to be like, imagine how terrible it would be to have the honor of being called to be a prophet, but to your enemies and resent the fact that your preaching is what averted disaster for your enemies, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. When you wanted your enemies to perish. Right.
Right.
Exactly. Right.
And you're sending me to give them words of salvation. You know? This is just too whimsical, God.
Yeah. Well, I think Jonah would use stronger language because he wants to die. He would probably say, this is immoral. This is immoral.
This is immoral.
You may be steadfast, but I find this immoral.
There's something kind of duplicitous about Jonah. You know, he says all the right words. But let's see, when he's in the belly of the big fish in chapter one, he prays to God for deliverance because that's about all you can do from the belly of a big fish. But what he does is he uses this language of pious religious utterance, which comes across as oily, you know, it's too smooth for words. In other words, it's not genuine anguish. It's kind of psalmic language, you know, language of the Psalms. I mean, to imagine the language of the Psalms being said by an unctuous person who really doesn't want to do what God wants is there's something going on here that is quite interesting. It's the portrait of a two-tongued person who seems to be religious, has a prophetic vocation, but who is really quite deceitful and angry.
You know, that sounds very familiar these days.
Yes. Gosh.
You know, It's when our commitment to righteousness and righteous words and a specific righteous position in the society is a real cover for the meanness of our spirit.
Yeah.
And we're going to use that righteousness to ensure that people are excluded, oppressed, diminished, murdered.
Yeah.
You know, and then you find out that God is loving those who you want to kill.
Yes. Althea, that's so good. Their God is too small. Their God is too small. Just too small.
But I can't, you know, those words in the reading that we have, I knew that you're a gracious God and merciful. I'm actually hurting as I hear those words.
Yeah,
I knew that you're a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and ready to relent from punishing. And I didn't like it. I want those people punished. I want you to hurt them.
That's so right.
I'm not happy that you're calling me to do this. It speaks so much to the meanness that exists.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Oh my gosh.
That's exactly right.
I was just trying to see how little we use Jonah on the one hand. Because this religious hypocrisy that we're talking about, Althea and Josh, I mean, this is a really interesting motif in our worlds of believers. But most people, you see, in comments on Jonah, commentaries and so on, think that Jonah is being appropriately pious from the belly of the big fish. Anyway, I was just interested to see that we only read two times in the whole of the lectionary cycle, the one we're following, we only read Jonah 3. We never read Jonah 1, so we never hear that when God says, Jonah, go to Nineveh, he goes in the opposite direction. So he's, you know, recalcitrant from the word go. We never hear that. We just read chapter 3, bits of chapter 3 in the ending. So that's not a lot of Jonah. Therefore, making much of Jonah in our context, as you are so rightly and helpfully pointing out, Althea, would be a good thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. And I was looking at some notes on Jonah, just very briefly, and saw where commentators dated to the 6th century, I think it is. And the idea that it's that returning Jews from exile, returning Israelites from exile, now find themselves in a situation where they have to comport with persons who do not share their traditions, do not share their histories, do not share their faith in Yahweh, nor the way they have come. And and some of them might have been historical enemies too. And so what is Yahweh's will? What is God's will in this situation? And if the levity in Jonah, because there is something satirical about an unctuous guy in the unctuous belly of an unctuous whale coming out to speak unctuous words.
You sound like Charles Dickens. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Go ahead.
You know, that the answer is that in God's economy, you know, God is going to be concerned about those with whom your only concern is to have animosity. You know, so how do we coexist inside of that kind of outcome where we have to realize that we do not have a right to diminish or reduce God's care for a diverse world?
That's great. Great.
I bet you some people, when they heard the story of Jonah, just stomped out the room with vexation. Thank you for making me laugh at Jonah today, because I think that has been very helpful to me, Deirdre.
Everything I know about Jonah, I learned from Phyllis Tribble. She wrote a book on Jonah as an example of rhetorical criticism. And she analyzed the text in a book introducing rhetorical criticism. So it became an exemplar of a form of analyzing the biblical text that she learnt as a graduate student from James Meilenberg. So it's kind of stuff handed down, you know, that has stood the test of time. And it was she that pointed out that it's not a whale, but it's a big fish, and there aren't any whales, and, you know, and Jonah is duplicitous and unctuous and deceitful and so on. So it's very helpful. It's very helpful, and it's always good to tell people that these aren't your ideas. These my ideas are from someone else who knows much better than I do. So, okay, should we stop here? Do anything else?
Well, I just wanted to say that I had always been kind of confused about Jesus saying that the sign that he will give the generation is the sign of Jonah. Mm. I mean, I understand it's 3 days in the belly of the tomb, but it also seems a little bit on the nose. And, you know, I was just wondering the degree to which there might be something more richer and deeper. What I mean by on the nose is just about every one of Jesus's parables or references like that have multiple layers of significance. And it's interesting to consider the ways in which his resurrection, for example, might mean something similar along these lines of reconciling enemies, something like that.
I see what you're getting at. What do you think, Althea?
I actually jumped very far ahead in response to what Josh just said, to Paul's letter to the Ephesians, where the purpose of Christ is to break down the dividing wall,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
very specifically, and mm-hmm. and to bring us all into the Commonwealth of Israel, so to speak, there. So that speaks to the idea that at some point in the unfolding tradition, after Jesus's passing, there is a sense, and it's a sense that Paul grapples with in the authentic Pauline letters of reconciliation, bringing people together into community to figure out how do you live together despite differences in this new kingdom of God.
Right, there's a sense in which you can configure a person like Paul in relationship to Jonah or mm-hmm. or Peter even, right? Mm-hmm. What's recounted in Acts or mm-hmm. something like this. Being summoned to do something that you initially have not just reservations about, but even, in Paul's case, you know, clear revulsion or opposition to, reaction against, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That was just it's not necessarily a direct reference, but it does seem to be embedded in that idea of a reference to Jonah in some mm-hmm. ways and in the mm-hmm. midst of this.
It is, yeah.
Especially saving one's enemies too.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's said to critics. These are critics to whom Jesus is speaking in Matthew 16 and Matthew 12. Yeah. He's talking about them as an evil and adulterous generation, asked for a sign, but no sign will be given to it. So he says this twice, once in 12 and once in 16. I don't think this is connected, just to follow this whole loop, to the beatitude he gives to Simon, son of Jonah. I think perhaps Matthew 16, 17 is just a reference to Simon bar Jonah, that it's a name that passes. It's in tradition. So it may not be the most euphonious name or the name with the happiest associations, but it seems to be a name. Also, the sign of Jonah passes into early Christian imagery in the catacombs and so on. The earliest images we seem to be finding, of course, there's always a chance we could find something else, but in the catacombs are the sheep on the shoulder of the shepherd, you know, the shepherd with the sheep around the shoulder. So that's as well as a pagan image, that's an early Christian sign of the good shepherd. It's good shepherd imagery. But the other thing is the whale. There's a whale. It is a whale at this point. It is a whale. But a big fish for sure, as a sign of resurrection. Yeah, it's a sort of coded thing. Ooh, whale, big fish, resurrection, 3 days, three nights. Yeah. In a language, in a symbol system that you want to keep underground.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's a good point, Josh.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. This was wonderful. Yeah, there's lots to preach on. We've given some good suggestions, I think, and we look forward to our next meeting. Thank you both immensely.
Thank you
both too.
It's been wonderful. Have a good week. Stay safe, everybody, and healthy and well. Goodbye.